Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
I tell everyone that asks to embrace the motto, stay out, stay alive. It is no joke. You're tempting fate each time you wriggle into an abandoned mine, especially without proper preparation and knowledge. Trespassing charges, cave-ins, and noxious gases are all dangers you face while venturing underground, but they're not the worst. Far from it. Many other things lurk in the mines, too. And I learned that the hard way. My friend and I ignored the signs, and I hope you can learn from our mistakes. During our freshman year in college, my roommate, Ben, and I stupidly began exploring abandoned mines for fun, and it soon turned into a hobby. We were both new to southern Ohio, where adits and shafts dotted the forests and hills like blemishes on an unkempt face. The long-abandoned mines were easy to come across and hard to stay out of if you were curious and dumb. Unfortunately, we were both. We discovered the thrill entirely by accident while on a hiking trip early on in the fall semester. I'd heard from a local guy about a ghost town hidden in the national forest surrounding our campus, and I asked Ben to help me find it. He obliged, and we went out hiking 1 week in search of it. I will not share the town's name here, but we successfully found the small community's remains. However, we were disappointed to see that only a few crumbled foundations were all that still stood, scattered about in a valley between two steep hills. There were no buildings left at all, nor the remnants of any roads. The forest had swallowed up the town almost entirely. We felt let down and were about to begin the long hike back to the car, when Ben stopped me and pointed out the entrance to what he thought was a small cave. It was tucked at the base of one of the hills, about 100 yards off from the nearest foundation and almost entirely obscured by the forest's thick vegetation. Only when we slipped inside did we realize that we had entered a crudely sealed coal mine. While the town above had rotted away to the point of obscurity, its former lifeblood had remained remarkably well preserved. The timbering supporting the roof still bore the soot stains from the miners' carbide lamps. A train of mine carts stood idle in the tunnel ahead of us, and we went to explore it with only cell phone flashlights. I found one of them filled with extra hardware and snagged an interesting-looking hinge that I still begrudgingly own. We only explored a bit further than the end of the mine train before deciding to head out. We agreed to come back some other time, more prepared, but I knew that wouldn't be very long. The first mine thoroughly teased my appetite for exploration, and I wanted more. Back in my dorm, I started to read up on mine exploration. It turns out many others shared my new interest. There was a whole community, in fact. And I must admit, free information from other explorers was abundant online, and the supplies they used weren't too expensive. I thought I could become a mine explorer also, and coddled myself with vague snippets of mine safety. I naively thought collapses and black damp were all I had to look out for. I hadn't given myself time to become aware of my own ignorance before I ordered oxygen detectors, hard hats, and high-powered flashlights, thinking they were all we needed to go below ground safely. I also found a public database created by the state government, and a compilation of all their information on current and past mining operations. One of the database's most convenient tools plotted the extent of every mine in the state on an easy-to-use map. Its purpose was to help homeowners determine if their properties were susceptible to subsidence, but I exploited it. The map gave precise coordinates of mine entrances and their corresponding underground maps, so I started a list of places to explore. It also kept track of which mine entries were inaccessible and which were still wide open. Even better was most of these mines were on public land, deep in the national forest and away from people. The likelihood of getting caught by rangers out there was near zilch. The Forest Service had a plan for sealing abandoned mines, but with hundreds of openings to deal with, it was impossibly expensive for them to patrol them all, much less seal them. This, combined with the information that I gleaned from the internet, meant Ben and I had a backlog of locations to explore, and no chance of incurring trespassing charges. And explore we did. The thrill of it continued to grow each time we checked another mine off the list, and we soon became bolder and more foolish. We were a couple of idiots. Hunting down the mines was no more challenging than searching for a public park online. The only difficulty we had was finding the overgrown entrances. It was like the ultimate form of geocaching, and we started to have too much fun with it, entering any mine works we found open, regardless of their condition. Then, one day, towards the end of the fall semester, it all came to a head, and we unknowingly hunted down the last mine we would ever explore. This mine had a name, but I've decided to rename it to Peytonville Mine for this story. I don't want anyone to discover its precise location, at least not as easily as I did. Even if someone pieces it together, they would no longer be able to enter this mine anyway, so I feel safe posting this. According to the maps and information, there was nothing too remarkable about the Peytonville mine other than its size. It operated for the better half of a century before closing down in the mid-1950s. By then, it had accumulated a maze of tunnels over the decades from mining both iron and coal. As such, it had a much grander entrance than anything else we had explored. Nearly 10 feet tall and reinforced with brick, like the entrance to a fancy train tunnel. However, a handful of monolithic concrete blocks impeded our passage into the mine. They were the kind of blocks used to construct a seawall, highway median. They looked new. A sign, a warning of trespassing charges, also stood out front. It bore the U.S. Forest Service logo and Smokey Bear's image, waving a finger saying, "Stay out, stay alive." The sign also looked relatively new, and we guessed that the Forest Service must have put them there in an attempt to seal the mine. These new signs and barriers worried me. The mine was most likely dangerous in some way. Remember, the Forest Service's budget only allowed them to seal a few dozen each year, and I knew that they prioritized based on the location of any given mine. Plus, this mine was far away from any roads or well-traveled trails, but we didn't heed these warnings. Ben pointed to a small hole between two of the blocks, about 6 feet off the ground. I knew that I was ignoring my gut. I soon found myself climbing up the barricade and shimmying through the narrow opening behind him. Once inside, I dropped back down to the floor and turned on my flashlight. This mine was nothing like any of the others we had entered. It was much more elaborate. I shined my light along the empty cart track and could not see the end. The miners had taken the time to line this tunnel with brick, continuing it from the entrance to form an arched passageway that served to prevent the main haulage tunnel from collapsing. It was also reminiscent of a small train tunnel. I felt safe in here, and the tunnel's condition seemed better than anything we'd ever seen before. I wondered why they took the time to try to seal this one. We started down the empty tunnel and continued for several hundred yards. Usually, the mines would have branched out into a grid by this point, but this one continued in a straight, brick-lined passageway for as far as our lights would shine. Ben suggested that the face of the mine might be miles back after years of operation. I agreed. He was probably right. The only deviations from the straight tunnel were small, evenly spaced setbacks that I thought only allowed miners to step out of the way of passing ore carts. They were nothing of interest until we arrived at one with some unusual graffiti, markings left by miners to alert each other to dangers and exit routes were not uncommon to find, but this piece of graffiti was different. It was a crudely drawn outline of a humanoid figure and lacked any other features aside from two red-painted eyes and the faint outline of a set of wings. Where the outline's chest should have been, there was a hole passing through the tunnel's brick wall. I took a picture and then shined my light through the hole to see what lay beyond. I could see that another part of the mine lay behind the wall, running off perpendicular to the main tunnel, another at it. I hypothesized that the other setbacks we walked must have also been other long-sealed adits. From what I read online, it was not uncommon for miners to seal off disused portions of their mines to improve air circulation, so this was not too weird of a find for me. I paid little attention to the graffiti. The small hole at its center interested me more. It was similar in size to the one we squeezed through at the mine's entrance, but someone had chiseled through the blocks to form this one. Ben started to push through before I could stop him, and I knew I had to go with him. We weren't stupid enough to ditch the buddy system. I bit my lips and followed him into the chest of the outline. Once through the wall, the construction of the tunnel changed entirely. No longer was the tunnel lined with brick, but instead was supported haphazardly by timbers. The ceiling was also much lower in there, and neither of us could stand up completely. This air looked much more like the other mines we had explored, and much closer to caving in. As we continued in this new direction, my trepidation increased as the ceiling quality decreased. Soon, we were walking across car-sized heaps of rock that had fallen from above. I suggested to Ben that we head back to the other tunnel, but he brushed off my worries and still wanted to explore this new one further, since we had no map of it. I continued to follow him, pleading about the mine's condition and reminding him that a cave-in would be the end of us. I knew this was not safe, but I could not leave him alone. Getting separated was the worst possible thing to happen underground. Eventually, we got to the point where the adit split into three different directions. Again, I told Ben we should head back. The fork was a likely indication that the adit branched out into a grid ahead of us. I didn't want to add to my list of worries with the thought of getting lost underground. I pleaded with Ben that we were risking both a cave-in and becoming lost, but he still ignored me. I turned back and started towards the hole, hoping he wouldn't be likely to go far without me. I waited for the sound of him scrambling to catch back up with me, but it never came. Instead, he trained his flashlight on something in the distance and started towards it. He beckoned me over, and I tried denying him, but he was adamant that I come to see what he had found. I shook my head in regret and started climbing over the fallen rocks to catch up with him. I stood next to him and shined my light at his discovery. For a moment, we stood there, trying to discern what our beams of light had illuminated. Something had dug out a divot into the gravel floor, forming a nest of sorts. In it laid a mess of shredded cloth, bedding, I assume. Ben thought we had found a large rat's nest, but I disagreed. This was too large to have been made by rats, and I had no idea where the cloth would have come from. We were nearly a quarter of a mile from the mine's entrance. This was too deep for even a rat to drag something this far. Even if someone tossed a bag of clothes right at the entrance, this was still too far. I started to feel uncomfortable. To my dismay, Ben stuck his hand into the pile of tattered cloth and dug around. He pulled out a soft-shelled egg, almost as large as that of an ostrich, and looked up at me in horror. The egg was somewhat translucent, and he held his light up to it. We could see something moving inside the semi-translucent shell. My curiosity overtook me at that point as well, and I went and pulled the cloth from the nest while Ben stood inspecting his egg. As I flung the foul-smelling material from the roost, I realized that the nest contained a whole clutch of these eggs. Dozens of them. All the little creatures inside squirmed as my light hit them. I had never seen anything like this, and I stumbled backwards and tripped over some of the rocks. Ben, still holding his egg, looked over to see what I discovered. He seemed just as unsettled as I was. I don't think either of us had any clue as to what we were looking at. As we looked worryingly at each other, We heard something rustle in the darkness in front of us. Ben scanned around the tunnels with his light, and his beam came to rest on a pair of red, reflective eyes further back in the darkness, and he almost dropped the flashlight. Alarmed at the sight before us, I aimed my light in the same direction and was horrified to illuminate the outline of another person standing in the tunnel, watching us, wearing what I thought was a trench coat. Although humanoid in form and standing on two legs, we soon learned this creature was not another human being. What I mistook for a coat wrapped around the creature's body unfurled into a pair of bat-like wings, with a span of a dozen feet at least. They'd almost touched the sides of the adit. Both Ben and I screamed. Ben threw the egg in his hands to the floor with a loud splat and ran past me. I picked myself up and ran after him, occasionally aiming my flashlight into the darkness behind us to check where the creature was. The last I saw, it was atop its nest, seeming to inspect the clutch of eggs for damage. An ear-piercing howl erupted through the cavernous space, and I rushed to cover my ears in response to the painful sound. It must have found the egg Ben threw. I couldn't stop running. I knew my safety depended on it. I dropped my hands and continued down the tunnel. Another wail ripped through the air, and I heard something shuffle on the rocks behind me. I knew that the creature was chasing after us. I did not need to turn around for confirmation. The sounds told me it was close. I ran like hell, kicking and stumbling my way down the tunnel. When I got to the hole, Ben was already halfway through. I could hear the creature approaching behind us, and I shoved Ben's legs the rest of the way through the void as I followed right behind him. I fell to the floor, on the other side of the wall, and scrambled back to my feet, aiming my flashlight back at the hole. I realized what the humanoid graffiti around it meant. It was another overlooked warning. The outline represented the creature on the other side. But I had little time to ponder this, as a pair of gnarled, claw-like hands started to push through the outline's chest. The creature stumbled through the hole before shaking itself off and wailing again. Ben and I continued down the main tunnel towards the mine's entrance. We ran like hell in the freedom of the larger tunnels, free of debris. Unfortunately, this freedom also applied to the creature. I heard its wings unfurl, and I could feel the wind as they began to flap in the enclosed space of the tunnel. I ducked as the creature flew past me and towards Ben. He didn't have the time to dodge, but instead managed to get one good blow on the thing's head with his flashlight as it swooped in on him. The creature fell to the floor in a heap, and its wings stopped moving. I wasted no time in jumping over the pacified beast and past my stunned roommate. I was determined to squeeze through the mine's exit first. I did not want to be the last one in the mine with that thing. I'm aware that sounds selfish, but those are the decisions you have to make when it's life or death. The final 100 yards of the tunnel felt like the longest distance I had ever run. I could see the light peeking through between the cracks of the barricade entrance, but my adrenaline slowed time to a crawl. I kept waiting for the creature to come at me from behind, but I got to the exit before that happened. I climbed up the barricade and started to squeeze through the hole, delighted to see the sunlit forest on the other side. I squirmed the rest of the way through, while Ben screamed at me to hurry. He said the creature was waking back up, and started to push on my feet in an attempt to speed me up. I fell the full 6 feet to the ground on the other side, landing on my head. I remember lying there, dazed, watching as Ben began to squeeze his way through. Ben started screaming again, this time that the creature had his feet, and I sprung back up and grabbed his arms. I pulled as hard as I could, but he wasn't budging. I told him to start kicking, which allowed me to get some headway, but I could hear the creature wailing in the tunnel behind him, still playing a fierce game of tug-of-war. As I fought to free Ben, I noticed that the creature seemed to be avoiding the beams of light that made it past Ben. After what seemed like an hour, but was likely only a minute, I won the battle, and again fell back to the ground, this time with my roommate landing directly on top of me. I pushed him to the side, and we both lay there, panting. We heard the monster moaning from inside the tunnel, but it didn't try and chase after us anymore. I was almost certain that if it weren't for the daylight, we'd be dead. I got up and started to dust myself off, and watched as Ben tried to do the same. However, as he tried to stand, he kept falling back. I looked down at his legs and yelled at him to stay on the ground. His right leg was mangled and looked broken. There was no way he could walk out on this injury inflicted by the creature. There was little chance of getting any reception this far into the forest, but we still tried. Neither of us had a single bar. We were too far away from the highway, which was the only area in the National Forest with consistent coverage. We had to formulate another plan. I was dizzying from hitting my head, but came to realize that I would have to hike out alone and bring back help. A ranger outpost was about 5 miles away, but I had parked the car 5 miles in the opposite direction. My roommate urged me to get help and leave him behind. I was apprehensive, but agreed that it was our only option. I gave him my pocket knife and started towards the station. Thankfully, GPS works just fine without service, and I wasn't worried about getting lost. I was worried that the thing from the mine would emerge and come after my roommates before I could come back with help. After all, the sunset was only a few short hours away. The hike was grueling, and I felt disoriented, but I trusted my phone's directions and eventually arrived at the small station almost 2 hours later, now with less than an hour until sunset. Luckily, I saw a ranger's utility vehicle parked out front, and I ran to the station's door and started banging. A young man, not much older than me, opened the door and brought me inside, introducing himself and asking why I needed help. For the sake of privacy, I'll call him Rick. I wasted no time telling Rick that my friend was injured and unable to hike out, but I reserved the details about entering the mine or the creature chasing it. Instead, I told him that Ben fell down a ravine nearby the mine. Rick grabbed his radio and asked if I knew my roommate's exact location. I told him we were hiking near one of the nearby creeks, which wasn't a complete lie, and gave him the coordinates for the mine's entrance, hoping he wouldn't catch on to our trip's real purpose. Rick shook his head as he looked at the coal dust smeared across my shirt. He knew the truth. I clearly remember what he said on the radio. "This is Rick from the Athens unit. I have an injury outside the Peytonville mine. All armed and available personnel, please respond. Sunset's in 45. Rick grabbed his rifle and some ammunition before ushering me out to his side-by-side. He loaded the gun and placed it in the back seat. I was scared shitless at this point and worried about Ben, but Rick looked me in the eyes and told me to calm down and tell him what had happened, honestly. He seemed both angry and intensely worried. I didn't lie about being in the mine and rambled off the story, sharing random details as I could remember them, including the nest, the outline warning, the wings. I'll never forget those wings. I thought my story came out entirely incoherent, but Rick started up the engine and told me, "Now, that story sounds about right." I wasn't for sure why he believed my crazy story, and his next question only confused me further. He asked me if I knew why the federal government had designated this land a national forest. I had no idea what the question had to do with that creature or the injury Ben sustained from it. Over the engine's roaring, and while navigating rugged trails, Rick began to give an impressive monologue, one that'll never forget. "Uncontrolled industry results in unforeseen consequences. That's just a fact of human nature. So, it's unsurprising that people mined and deforested these lands into a veritable wasteland within a couple of generations of European settlement. And this happened not just here, but across the country. In response, the federal government created the Forest Service and National Park System to restore that damage and preserve our country's national resources for further generations. Although, to tell you the truth, that's only part of what we do. We've always known that protecting the forests means more than just wildfire prevention and tree planting. There are extreme dangers here, too. Things that most people don't believe in. We prefer to handle some things in secrecy, and it's like that around any national forest or park. You see, there are places in this world, like here in this forest, where hell is a bit closer to the surface. And when the mines started going deeper, They uncovered things that should have stayed buried. Supernatural might be a good word, but the point is we've got to protect people from threats they don't even know exist. What you saw today is one of the things that our rangers work hard to keep underground, all across the continent. The miners before us knew this too, and did what they could to keep things calm as well. That outline on the sealed tunnel you told me about was a warning to other miners not to unleash what hid behind the wall. If I had to guess, they knew what was in there. Us rangers are just the latest in a long line of stewards for lands like this. The miners before us, and the Native Americans before them, didn't doubt the supernatural. They accepted the dangers that lurked around them. Nowadays, people don't believe in anything like that. But it's still real, so we just do our work in secret. Besides, I don't think today's society could handle the truth anymore. This information stunned me, to say the least, and I was unsure how to respond. For a second, I believed that Rick was joking with me for interrupting his evening, especially since my roommate's injury occurred in an abandoned mine that was very much off-limits. I must have looked confused and skeptical of his story, because Rick said to me, "Your story was quite fantastical, too. I guess we'll just have to believe one another." He tapped the loaded rifle in the seat behind him, and I knew he wasn't joking either. As we sped through the dirt roads and trails back towards where I had left my roommate, Rick told me more about the Rangers' additional duties. He said they'd been having problems with the Peytonville mine for years, ever since it closed and the miners stopped maintaining the walls within the mine. Creatures would break out every so often, and the Forest Service had to hunt them down before they came across the public. Years ago, in the 1960s, Rick said one of the creatures, similar to what Ben and I saw, escaped from some miners a few states over. The beast wreaked havoc for several nights before the Forest Service could hunt it down and put a bullet through it. Although, enough people claimed to have seen it that the creature had become cemented in Appalachian folklore in the years since then. Rick thought I'd seen the same beast, and he didn't want another escape to occur. As we neared the mine entrance, Rick asked me again if I was sure that we came across a nest with eggs while we were underground. I told him I was positive, and reminded him that the creature revealed itself after my roommate picked up one of its eggs, and only chased us after he threw the egg. Rick bit his lip and seemed worried about this detail. He said that the creature was going to be vengeful for screwing with its nest. I looked up to the sun low in the sky, and then back to Rick, and knew we didn't have a moment to waste. As we came around the final curve in the trail leading to the mine, I could see Ben still lying where I had left him nearly 2 hours earlier. He shouted and waved his hands, screaming that I had taken too long. He said the creature had been wailing and taunting him since we left. While Rick and I helped Ben into the bed of the utility vehicle, we heard another wail emanate from the edit. Rick rustled for his rifle. He told us that the sun would be down soon, and they needed to solve the problem by then. He got on his radio and asked when the other rangers would arrive. I heard the garbled voices of several others reply they were only several minutes out. With Ben lying softly in the back of the utility vehicle, Rick headed towards the mine with his rifle cocked. He shouted for me to stay behind while he trained his rifle at the singular hole leading into the otherwise barricaded edit. "I'm guarding there still backup arrives." A couple of minutes later, one of the other rangers showed up in a four-wheeler with a crate strapped to the back. He pulled up beside Rick and quickly hopped off the rummage through the rear of the ATV, eventually producing what appeared to be several sticks of dynamite. Rick seemed to discuss the situation for a minute with his cohort while he stood with his rifle trained on the small, dark hole. Eventually, he yelled back to us to prepare for a boom and said that they planned to collapse the entrance to seal in both the creature and its offspring. "We gotta get this closed up before it gets dark. That bitch'll emerge with a vengeance." The other ranger finished taping the sticks together and moved closer to the entrance. He looked up to the hole and then to the explosives in his hand. He seemed nervous. Rick cheered him on and yelled at him to climb up the barricade and toss it in. The ranger slowly climbed the concrete blocks to the small hole level and reached for a lighter from his pocket. He balanced on a small ledge as he lit the explosive's long fuse, but as he threw the bundle into the orifice of the mine, a clawed arm reached from within and grabbed a hold of the ranger's arm. The creature's skin started to smoke in the sunlight, but I don't think it cared. It then pulled the ranger into the mine, lit explosives and all, with one powerful movement. The man went quiet, only having time for a slight gasp of surprise before entirely disappearing into the mine. Rick lowered his weapon, with a stunned look on his face, and ran away from the added entrance, taking cover behind a fallen tree. He screamed for us to duck and cover, but I couldn't peel my eyes out. I watched in horror as the creature's wings pushed through the hole as it attempted to escape the bomb it just brought inside its lair. Right when its hellish face poked through, the dynamite went off and blew the thing to bits, collapsing the mine entrance in the process. The explosion was incredible. As the debris and dust settled, I could tell the Peytonville mine entrance was utterly obliterated, well and truly sealed. The hazard sign placed out front by the Forest Service still stood, but bent and tattered, its purpose now redundant. Nothing would ever get in or out of that mine ever again. Or so I hoped. Three other rangers arrived only minutes after the explosion and ran to Rick, who was still lying on the ground, clutching his rifle. One of them yelled at Rick, demanding to know what had just happened and where the missing ranger was. Rick pointed towards the collapsed adit and said, "It took him in with the dynamite." Ben got away with a broken leg, and I only sustained a few bruises, but dealing with the situation's trauma was much worse. The Forest Service never made any public announcements about the ranger killed in the blast, and they wrote it off as an accident. No one other than the rangers believed our story, and even still, they have publicly denied the events I wrote about. But I understand their decision in a way. The public wouldn't believe them even if they told the truth, and people ridicule what they don't understand. However, I still hope some of you will believe my story and heed my warning to stay out of abandoned mines. And just remember, there are people out there, like the forest ranger, who work in the shadows to protect us from things we can't understand. And they do it all without the expectation of glory or recognition. Try and respect everyone, because you never know who the hidden heroes are.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.